The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
Hello, KORC listeners. This is Wendy Byrne, dishing information from the Corvallis Civics Cafe. On the menu this week, a healthy serving of information about the city council elections, who is running, and how you can find information. A wedge of opinion about the latest update on the legal proceedings involving Councillor Ellis and the City of Corvallis. And an after-dinner drink of agenda items for the city meetings this coming week. Let's get into it. The elections approach. Voters' pamphlets arrived last week, and this week, ballots started arriving. Corvallis is made up of 9 wards, and every 2 years we vote for who gets to represent us. Do you realize that Corvallis is the only city in the state of Oregon where our councilors serve 2-year terms? Most cities have 4-year terms. Well, in Corvallis, we like 2-year terms. Change is afoot for the membership of City Council, with some longer-serving members deciding to step away and some fresh faces on the local campaign trail. In total, there are 17 people running for City Council. Despite that high number, the distribution of candidates varies from ward to ward. Here is a list of the candidates. Ward 1, incumbent Jan Napak is running against Beckett Hunt. Ward 2, incumbent Bria Lewis is running against Dylan DeHonor. Ward 3, there's no incumbent running, and this leaves Jim Moorfield and Mark Territute competing for the office. In Ward 4, there is no incumbent, and Ava Olson is running unopposed. In Ward 5, incumbent Charlyn Ellis is running unopposed. In Ward 6, no incumbent is running. There are 3 candidates for this ward. They are, in alphabetical order, Allison Bowden, Brennan Kohlberg, and Richard Masella. In Ward 7, incumbent Paul Schaefer is running against 2 challengers, Andrea Bybee and Roy Rubin. In Ward 8, there is no incumbent running, and Carolyn Mayers is running unopposed. In Ward 9, the incumbent Tony Cadena is running against Karen Jean Kanan. In Corvallis, our mayor serves a 4-year term, and the next mayoral election will be in 2026. More detailed information about city elections can be found on the city website at corvallisoregon.gov/elections. Election information can also be found on the Benton County website at bentoncountyor.gov/elections, as the county runs the elections for all of the local municipalities. While there is useful information in the voter's pamphlet, there are many other places to find information about the candidates. You have options. Recently, there have been news articles published in the Gazette Times, which can be accessed online and in their print editions. Copies of the print edition can be read at your local branch of the Benton County Public Library. The Corvallis Advocate has teamed with the City Club of Corvallis to host debates for each of the 6 council wards that are contested. They are hosting 2 debates a week and have been posting them on their website at corvallisadvocate.com and on their YouTube channel at Corvallis Advocate. Currently, they have posted debates for wards 1, 3, 6, and 7, with wards 2 and 9 to be posted next week. After all the debates are posted, the Advocate plans to publish their endorsements on Friday, October 25th. The local branch of the NAACP has a 2024 general election voter guide on their website at lynnbentonnaacp.com/political action. Additionally, the Lynn Benton NAACP teamed with the Corvallis League of Women Voters and recorded candidate forums for the contested races for Corvallis City Council, Benton County Commissioner, and House District 16. The recordings for wards 1, 2, 3, 6, 7, and 9 can be accessed from the League's website at lwvcorvallis.org/vote. The League has additional information about voting on that website, and I encourage everyone to spend time there watching these forums, especially if you live in one of the contested wards, wards 1, 2, 3, 6, 7, or 9. Please vote. Our democracy is better when we all participate. Moving on, I think I promised a wedge of opinion on the legal proceedings involving Councillor Ellis in the city of Corvallis. Before my opinion, some facts. On October 17th, the Gazette Times ran Ella Hutcherson's latest installment of coverage about Ellis v. City of Corvallis. If you are expecting big news, please resume breathing normally, because there is no new information. The case is stuck in a holding pattern. As stated in the Gazette Times, quote, "The case is trapped in legal purgatory, as its last brief was filed with the U.S. District Court on May 14th, according to the City of Corvallis Public Information Officer Patrick Rollins. The court has not taken any action since that time, and both sides are waiting for additional developments, which could include an injunction against the city, stopping it from removing Ellis," unquote. Later in the article, Hutcherson quotes Ward 7 City Councilor Paul Schaefer, saying, quote, "The city has spent way too much money addressing something that probably could and should have been resolved almost a year ago now," unquote. For the record, as of June of 2024, the city had spent upwards of $200,000 on the case, and if Ellis is reelected come November 5th, which is likely due to the fact that she is running unopposed, she cannot be removed from office for something that happened in her previous term. The full article can be found online at gazettetimes.com/news/local. As for that wedge of opinion, for several reasons, I find it challenging to assert that a violation of the charter occurred. Councillor Ellis did not ask the city manager to hire anyone specific. Perhaps the language in her motion was unacceptable, but the motion was amended during the city council meeting, and then the city council passed the resulting motion with unanimous vote. The charter language is over 60 years old and desperately in need of revision. For these reasons and more, it appears as if there is some personal vendetta to remove this councillor from her office, and the interpretation of the charter has been manipulated past the point of reason. Because the charter is weak in its language, and our city council is made up of non-career politicians who don't understand their powers, we play this expensive waiting game, hoping time will expire and the case will magically disappear. For what? So that we can move forward with no good answers to any of this mess? I'm sorry, I don't have more exciting news. It's sort of like opening a bottle of hot sauce to find out that someone has filled it with ketchup. Not what you wanted. Let's get on to that after-dinner drink about the city meetings coming up this week. On Monday, the city council will be meeting on the second floor of the downtown fire station starting at 6 p.m., They are expecting the final report and recommendation from the Community Civic Campus Engagement Task Force, and they will be authorizing the full faith and credit bond for the Parks Maintenance Facility project. On Tuesday, there will be a meeting of the Corvallis Climate Action Advisory Board starting at 4:30 p.m. in the Madison Avenue meeting room. On Wednesday, the Corvallis Forest Stewardship Plan Update Task Force is meeting at 5 p.m. in the Madison Avenue meeting room. And on Thursday, the City Council will round out the week with their work session meeting from 4 to 6 p.m. in the Madison Avenue meeting room. There are options to attend all of these meetings in person or via Zoom, and additional information can be found on the city's website at corvallisoregon.gov. On the menu for next time, I plan to review the voting records of the four City Council incumbents and will share how they voted on critical issues and how these votes might compare with the statements they have made in the voter's pamphlet and in their interviews. Because sometimes it is easier to talk that talk than it is to walk that walk. Thanks for joining me here at the Corvallis Civics Cafe. If you have comments or feedback, send me an email at wendy@korcfm.com. And if you have feedback for KORC's news, music, and civics program, email us at news@korcfm.com. Until next time, this is Wendy Byrne for KORC's News, Music, and Civics.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayre. On Monday, October 21st at 5 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will meet in an executive session to discuss employee performance-related issues. The location of the meeting will be in the Council's chambers at the downtown fire station, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. Also on Monday, October 21st, but at 6 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be having a regular meeting at the downtown fire station in the Council's chambers, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. The meeting will also be held virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for more details. On Tuesday, October 22nd at 4:30 p.m., the Climate Action Advisory Board meeting will be held in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. The meeting will also be held virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the meeting online. On Wednesday, October 23rd at 5 p.m., The Corvallis Forest Stewardship Plan Update Task Force will be meeting at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. The meeting will also be held virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join. On Thursday, October 24th at 4 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be having a work session that will be held both virtually as well as in person. The in-person location will be at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. For details on how to join online, see CorvallisOregon.gov. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Serra.
It's time for another KORC Eco Report. The following information was provided by Biology Insights. The Oregon giant earthworm lives in the rich, loamy soils of Oregon's Willamette Valley. These earthworms are often found in deep, well-drained soils that are rich in decaying plant material. The presence of such organic matter is crucial, as it serves as their primary food source. The soil composition in these areas typically includes a mix of clay, silt, and sand, which allows for adequate drainage while retaining enough moisture to support the earthworm's needs. The dense canopy of the old-growth forests also plays a role in maintaining soil's moisture levels and creating a stable microhabitat. Human activities such as agriculture and urban development have significantly impacted the distribution of the Oregon giant earthworm. Conversion of forest to farmland and urban areas has led to habitat fragmentation, making it increasingly difficult for these earthworms to find suitable living conditions. Conservation efforts are now focusing on preserving the remaining old-growth forests and restoring degraded habitats to ensure the survival of this unique species. The Oregon giant earthworm exhibits distinct physical traits that make it a fascinating subject for researchers. One of the most striking features is its extraordinary length, which can reach up to 4 feet. This remarkable size sets it apart from most other earthworm species. Its elongated body is composed of numerous segments called annuli, which are clearly visible along its length and contribute to its flexible movement through soil. The skin of the Oregon giant earthworm possesses a translucent, pale pink or purplish hue, allowing a glimpse of its internal organs and the soil it ingests as it burrows. This is not only visually intriguing, but also serves a functional purpose, aiding in the exchange of gases through the skin, a process vital for its respiration. The skin is coated with a thin layer of mucus, which helps in reducing friction as the earthworm moves and also aids in moisture retention, essential for its survival in the subterranean environment. Its sensory organs are adapted to its underground lifestyle. Although lacking eyes, its specialized cells, known as photoreceptors, detect changes in light intensity, helping it to avoid surface exposure where it might be more vulnerable to predators. Additionally, its body is equipped with chemoreceptors and mechanoreceptors, enabling it to sense chemical changes in the soil and physical vibrations, respectively. These sensory adaptations are crucial for locating food sources and avoiding potential threats. The earthworm's muscular system is highly developed, allowing it to navigate through the dense, compact soils of its habitat. It possesses both longitudinal and circular muscles, which work in a coordinated manner to produce the characteristic undulating movement of earthworms. This efficient locomotion mechanism is crucial for its role in soil aeration and organic matter decomposition, processes that significantly contribute to soil health. Like many earthworms, the Oregon giant earthworm is hermaphroditic, meaning each individual possesses both male and female reproductive organs. This dual capability maximizes their reproductive potential, making it possible for any two mature individuals to mate, a significant advantage in the often isolated underground environment. Mating typically occurs in the moist soil during the warmer months when conditions are optimal. The process begins with two earthworms aligning themselves ventrally, exchanging sperm through a mucus sheath that envelops both partners. This mutual exchange of sperm ensures genetic diversity, which is crucial for the health and the resilience of the population. They're stored in structures called spermatheci, allowing for delayed fertilization, which can be timed to coincide with favorable environmental conditions. Following mating, the earthworm will produce a cocoon, a small lemon-shaped structure where fertilization and early development occur. The cocoon is secreted by the clitellum, a glandular section of the earthworm's body, and is deposited in the soil. Inside the cocoon, fertilized eggs undergo embryonic development, protected from desiccation and predators by the tough outer layer. The number of eggs per cocoon can vary, but typically only a few juvenile earthworms emerge, each fully formed and ready to begin life in the soil. Juveniles must rapidly gain size and strength to navigate through their environment and reach reproductive maturity. This growth period can span several months, depending on soil conditions and food availability. As a detritivore, this earthworm primarily consumes decaying organic matter, particularly leaf litter and other plant debris that accumulate on the forest floor. Using its muscular, extendable pharynx, the earthworm draws in organic material, where it's then transported to its mouth through rhythmic contractions. Once the organic material enters the mouth, it travels through the digestive tract, where a series of specialized structures work to extract nutrients. The food first passes through the esophagus and then into the crop, a storage chamber where it's temporarily held. From the crop, it moves to the gizzard, a muscular organ that grinds the food into finer particles using small ingested stones. This mechanical digestion is crucial for breaking down the tough, fibrous plant material that constitutes the earthworm's diet. Chemical digestion occurs as the finely ground plant material progresses into the intestine. Here, enzymes and symbiotic microorganisms break down the organic matter further, allowing for the efficient absorption of nutrients. These microorganisms play a vital role by decomposing complex compounds that the earthworm's own enzymes cannot process. The symbiotic relationship between the earthworm and these microbes enhances digestive efficiency and contributes to the overall fertility of the soil. The Oregon giant earthworm plays an indispensable role in soil aeration and nutrient cycling, processes that are fundamental to maintaining healthy ecosystems. As these worms burrow through the soil, they create extensive networks of tunnels that facilitate the movement of air and water. This aeration process is crucial for the health of plant roots as it ensures that they receive adequate oxygen and moisture, which are essential for growth and nutrient uptake. In addition to aeration, the earthworm's feeding and digestive activities significantly contribute to nutrient cycling. The ingestion and breakdown of organic matter result in the production of nutrient-rich castings, which are excreted back into the soil. These castings are highly beneficial as they contain concentrated levels of essential nutrients such as nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. The presence of these nutrients enhances soil fertility, promoting robust plant growth and supporting a diverse array of soil organisms. The continuous turnover of organic material and the subsequent release of nutrients creates a dynamic and balanced ecosystem. Despite their ecological importance, Oregon giant earthworms face numerous threats from both natural predators and human activities. Understanding these challenges is essential for developing effective conservation strategies. Predators of the Oregon giant earthworm include various birds, mammals, and even other invertebrates. Robins and thrushes are particularly adept at locating and extracting earthworms from the soil. Mammals like moles and shrews also pose a threat as they actively hunt earthworms. These natural predators play a role in controlling earthworm populations, but their impact is generally balanced by the earthworm's reproductive capabilities. Human activities pose a more significant threat to the giant earthworm. Habitat destruction due to agriculture, urban development, and deforestation has led to substantial declines in their populations. The fragmentation of old-growth trees reduces the availability of suitable habitats, making it increasingly difficult for these earthworms to survive. Additionally, the introduction of non-native species, such as invasive earthworms and predatory invertebrates, further exacerbates the challenges faced by the Oregon giant earthworm.
Hi, everyone. This is Lava Lamp Larry. And today, my news article is going to be simply reading from a book that everyone should have. And I hope that you will read it at home because you probably have this book. I call it a book, but officially it is the Voter's Pamphlet for the Oregon General Election, November 5th, 2024. That means it's coming up quickly. So what I'm going to do is give you an overview of the measures that are on the ballot. They probably don't get the kind of publicity that they either deserve or don't deserve, but I'm going to just sort of lay this out quickly. And today we're just going to tackle a couple of these measures. I'm going to start with Measure 115, which amends the Constitution and authorizes impeachment of statewide elected officials by the Oregon legislature with a two-thirds vote by each House. And it establishes the process to do that. So a yes vote for Measure 115 would authorize and establish a process for the Oregon legislature to impeach statewide elected officials. House initiates impeachment with a two-thirds vote. The Senate would try and convict with a two-thirds vote. The Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court oversees any impeachment trial. A no vote retains current law and does not authorize the Oregon legislature to impeach and remove statewide elected officials. And here's a summary. And again, I am quoting verbatim from the voter's pamphlet, and you can check it out for yourself. It's page 45. This amends the Oregon Constitution to grant the Oregon House of Representatives the power to impeach statewide elected officials in the executive branch and to grant the Oregon Senate the power to try an impeachment received from the House. Currently, the statewide elected officials of the executive branch are the governor, secretary of state, state treasurer, attorney general, and commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. At present, the only way to remove these officials is through a recall election. The measure permits the House to impeach for malfeasance, corrupt conduct in office, willful neglect of constitutional duty, or other felony or high crime. Requires a yes vote of at least two-thirds, which would be 40 representatives, to send an impeachment resolution to the state Senate. Requires the Senate to conduct impeachment trial and requires a yes vote of at least two-thirds of senators, that would be 20 senators, to convict. The Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court would preside. So this measure amends the Constitution. There is really no financial impact, as noted in the voter's pamphlet. So that is the basic rundown of Measure 115. Let's move on now to Measure 116. And let's remember that I'm not giving you argues in favor, argues against, because there's a lot of that to be read in the voter's pamphlet, but we are just doing an overview of today, at least, a couple of these measures. Okay, Measure 116, page 48, would amend the Constitution, establishes an independent public service compensation commission to determine salaries for specified officials, eliminates legislative authority to set those salaries. A yes vote amends the Constitution to establish a commission to determine salaries paid by the state to specified officials, replacing the current practice of establishing such salaries by legislation. Provides that determinations of the commission are automatically funded. A no vote retains the current law whereby salaries paid by state to officials specified officials are established by legislation. So simply put, this takes the process of paying these specified people out of the hands of the legislature and puts it in the hands of a commission. So that's a quick overview of measures 115 and 116. Let's move on to 117. 117 is already in use in the city of Corvallis, for example, where voters have the option to rank candidates in order of preference. This is done for any election in Corvallis that has more than two candidates. So that has been done already in the 2022 election. There were three candidates in, I believe, two of the wards, so ranked choice voting was used. Measure 117, a yes vote gives voters the option to rank candidates in order of preference for specified federal and statewide offices, establishes process for tallying votes in rounds, with the candidate receiving the fewest votes in each round being defeated, votes for the defeated candidate going to the voter's next highest ranked active candidate, and it requires that the candidate must receive majority of votes in the final round of voting to win an election. This is not something I can explain for you easily on the radio, but I believe if you turn to page 54 in your voter's pamphlet and read through the impact of ranked choice voting, Measure 117, you'll have a pretty good idea of where the future may lie, because a number of states are turning to this as opposed to just, here's two candidates, yes, no. If there are more than two candidates, which is a process that I believe is really healthy for a democracy, the ranked choice voting is a great option, I believe. Make up your own mind. Read the voter's pamphlet, okay? I'll be back next time looking at the final two measures on the Oregon ballot for 2024, that being 118 and 119. Today we reviewed 115, 116, 117. Get out there and vote. For KORC News, I'm Lava Lamp Larry.
You're listening to KORC News, Music and Civics, a program you can hear Sundays from 1 to 2 and repeated Mondays 5 to 6 p.m. here on KORC, Community Radio for Corvallis. This is Dan Krall, and I am downtown at the Welcher Building. You may wonder, where is that? Well, it's along Madison Avenue between 4th and 5th Streets. The fancy Castor restaurant is downstairs, and I am upstairs, joined right now by Adrian Fritz. And Adrian is an artist, a creativepreneur, a game creator, and some of you might be familiar with Conundrum House. She is part of the brains behind that project. Thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So I came in here early in the week and just happened to start talking to you about Conundrum House. I wanted to see what this space was like, and it turns out you all are in a transition and moving your space here at the Welcher Building, or at least condensing your space.
It's a combination of condensing. We're actually closing the game rooms and the public access to the library shortly because we're looking for a new location.
Oh, when is that closure happening?
We will be closed on November 24th. Our sale begins November 1st, and we are actually liquidating a lot of property.
Well, why don't we actually walk through the game room here? If you come upstairs at the Welcher Building, you can see the Conundrum House sign outside of this plaza. And inside, there's all sorts of games, role-playing games, puzzles. What else?
We have mechanical puzzles. So if you love like those metal puzzles that fall apart and you try to put them back together, we've got a bunch of that. We have a bunch of Kickstarter games. We have over 700 board games, RPGs, jigsaw puzzles, from the very high-end wooden jigsaw puzzles to crazy, wacky magic puzzles that by the end of it, you've transformed the puzzle itself.
Not to mention really fancy tables where one or a group could come and play.
Yes, we can accommodate up to, in this space, about 18 players. So between this room and then the immersion room, the Durlacoke Private Detective Agency, we can have up to four people playing, solving cold cases in that room.
Why don't we head back towards this small room, which is inside of the game room, where we have all these different games, and we've got a chess set up over here, a nice couch. A little room here behind the beads with books. And here we are in, what's the name of this room again?
The Derlecoque Private Detective Agency.
It's just kind of a small office with the curtain drawn. It's got a dark, sealed feel.
Yeah, it was modeled after, of course, the noir detective agency sort of feel. Except we have a magnetic whiteboard, which is your case board, or some people would call it your murder board.
And what? How does one get the most out of the experience that this room and everything offers?
Well, the part that this serves is our drop-in play all day, which up until the end of this month, it's $7.50 per person, and you can come and go all day from open to close, 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. You can come in here and grab any case you want to solve a cold case mystery. Most of them are murders. We do have one that's a missing rabbit that actually is one of our most difficult cases. So it's like a school-oriented case.
What kind of people generally are drawn to these sorts of puzzles?
I'm going to say primarily women between the ages of 30 and on up. I'm 64, so this is my brainchild, this piece. But women also tend to drag their kids, their husbands, their partners, their friends along with them. But I'll tell you, we've got a lot of 20 and 30-somethings who really love this space. So you'll see them all crammed in here, up to five people, which I don't recommend. It's a very small room. But they've done it, right? You know, they just cram in here and they solve a case. And sometimes it's date nights, too. So we've had a lot of dates happen up here over time.
It is a unique business in Corvallis. You're not going to find something like this just anywhere. And from what I understand, you currently have four different rooms rented out here in the upstairs of the Welcher building?
Yeah, we probably have at least 60% of the floor space up here. And each room is dedicated to a particular activity. So we have our office space, which is our smallest space. We have a studio that includes our paper and our electronic prop studio, because we build props for our non-local events, our cold cases that we do out in the community and our fundraisers. And so we still produce all of that work, the newspapers, just everything. So we have a studio. And then we have, of course, this space, which we call our play space, that houses the rental library, which is our play all day library, and then this experience and a very tiny footprint for digital gaming. So we do have a PS3. We have games that you play with Amazon Alexa, et cetera. But we're trying to get people away from that. So the space is very tiny for that.
Do people ever play D&D, Dungeons and Dragons here?
Oh, heavens, yes. A lot. Cool. Even team building. So we do have one robotics company that actually every 6 months comes up here for a team building exercise, and they've done D&D thus far. However, they're looking at possibly doing a murder mystery next time.
Okay.
Yeah.
I see over here we have some bound skis, which if you ever come to the KORC Saturday Market booth, JC and others during the Saturday Market season, we've got a Bounsky table that was custom made for us by Justin of Bounsky. You can find out more about the Bounsky itself at bounskee.fun. And while I'm mentioning websites, what is the website for Conundrum House?
It's conundrum.house, not .com, but conundrum.house.
Conundrum.house. That's kind of easy to remember.
Kind of, yeah.
Why don't we make our way over to the space where you were telling me earlier off the mic that you were going to be condensing into this office space, which is also on the upper level here at the Welcher building, which I would say the look of this space alone, the unique furniture, the vibe, the photographs that you have on display, a curio cabinet with some china, that alone is worth just coming to have a look.
Just a look-see, absolutely. We're going to retain the look of this, but this will become our offices and also our team design space. So we do, especially when we work on our history mystery clue hunts, we have historians come in, we have researchers, we have writers. So they all become part of the project team, and we need space for that. And so we're retaining this bigger space to be able to accommodate all that.
How long have you been in this space?
We've been upstairs for over 5 years. We started out with 72 square feet where we tested the concept during the art walk. We expanded to 750 square feet when that back studio opened up. So the front half, that's now my fine art studio, was the original Conundrum House. And the back side was a forensic CSI lab. And then COVID hit.
Oh, what a great time.
Oh, yeah. Terrible timing.
How has the community response been overall to this space and using Conundrum House?
It's not been as responsive as we'd hoped, but part of it is our location. We don't have signage on the building. You know, there's a lot of, we've had a lot of, and these are some of our members who've been with us for 3 years since we reopened. They're like, you know, it took us 6 tries to find your place. So the location itself has been very problematic for us. Like, people know about us, they talk about us, they plan to come see us, but then they can't find us.
Well, you're between 4th and 5th Street along Madison, upstairs from the Castor restaurant.
That is where we currently are. And so we're mothballing the retail, the rental program for a short while, and the immersion rooms until we move to a new location. We're in talks with a building owner who's developing another space.
Oh, so it wouldn't even be here at the Welcher building?
Eventually, that piece of it will be someplace else. We may retain this as our workspace because we love it. We've been here for 5 years, 6 years, 7 years. A really long time.
Well, I feel that Corvallis is a unique town, and when you get down to the nitty-gritty of it, there are a lot of unique offerings that sometimes we just have to step out and discover, whether it's outside of our comfort zone or something like, oh, yeah, I've been meaning to check that out. Because, I mean, I know firsthand as a former small business owner in this town, unique businesses only survive if people support them.
Yes, yes. And we do have a plan. We created a customer advisory board. Those are our most rabid customers, our biggest fans. And with them, we've created a crowdfunding campaign to relaunch the store and the immersion rooms in the new space that we're negotiating for. So look out for that. So this is not, the idea is not dead and gone. It's just it didn't work where we are. It doesn't really support itself. So we're focusing on how to rebuild our business, do the things that do bring in money so we can reinvest with the community's assistance in the play space, which is an incredible experience.
And you had mentioned that you do off-site activities as well. Why don't you talk about that aspect of your business?
Sure. One of the largest things we do is called Specters Past. It's a history mystery clue hunt, and we work with visitor centers, downtown revitalization groups, historic groups, the museum, the Historic Resources Commission, different places where the history of their area is very important to them. And we develop an interactive clue hunt game based on their resources that they're offering us and then the voices of people from the past who speak not in English or Russian, but in puzzles. And so it's gamified to a very fun and interesting way where you are working through all these puzzles to learn about the history, but also how to incorporate those lessons into today to create some new choices for our future together. History is important from that aspect, not from just an educational, but like we need to know where we're going by not making some mistakes from the past.
Indeed. We are speaking with Adrienne Fritz, who, along with her partner Mark Vanderpool, heads up the Conundrum House, as well as what are the names of your other businesses?
Our overarching business is Remarkable Arts, and that's a whole nother conversation. We do other projects as well, and that's pretty much it. Conundrum House is kind of my focus.
And as we stated at the beginning of the report, you are having a liquidation sale in November, is it?
Yes, it starts November 1st. It closes on November 24th. So you've got that 24-day window to come down here, pick up some amazing antique furniture, games, etc. So we're retaining a good chunk of our library, but we're also stuff that we have duplicates of or easy to replace items that are popular. Those will be sold off, and then we'll just have a smaller, very curated collection because I need it for my research.
Well, thank you again for your time. And can you give us the website one more time if listeners are curious to check out the Conundrum House or some of these other adventures you have going?
Absolutely. It's conundrum.house.
All right. Adrian Fritz, thanks again for your time today.
Thank you.
This is a press release from earthobservatory.nasa.gov regarding a comet which we can see in our night sky from Corvallis. Currently, if you look just after sunset towards the west in the region of Mary's Peak, if it's a clear night, you should be able to see this comet. Earth-based observers looking to the night sky may be treated to a once-in-80,000-years sight in autumn 2024. Comet C/2023 A3 Tsuchinshan Atlas, which likely traveled from the outer reaches of our solar system, made its closest transit past the Sun on September 27th and was expected to come within approximately 44 million miles of Earth on October 12th. The comet was visible primarily to those in the southern hemisphere and the tropics until about October 8th. Viewers in the northern hemisphere would get more opportunities to catch a glimpse in subsequent days. Crew aboard the International Space Station have also been observing the Tsuchinshan Atlas on its journey through the inner solar system. An astronaut captured a photo of the comet on September 19, 2024. At that time, the mass of dust, ice, and rock was approaching the closest point to the Sun on its highly elliptical orbit. When a comet approaches the Sun, it gets warmer. Heat causes its ice to sublimate into gases, and these gases and dust become a glowing coma and tail that can extend millions of miles. The dust tail of Tsuchinshan Atlas extends upward, and a second type of tail, the ion tail, will be faintly visible pointing down and to the right. The Sun influences the two types of tails in different ways, often sending them in different directions. The heat and pressure of sunlight push particles in the dust tail away from the Sun, though the tail may bend slightly in the direction of the comet came from. Likewise, the solar wind strips ions off the comet's surface to create the ion tail, which may extend at a different angle. Some comets do not survive close encounters with the Sun. If they get too close, radiation and gravitational forces may disintegrate them completely. Tsuchinshan Atlas did not suffer this fate, but another comet astronomers were watching, C24S1 Atlas, may have. Recent data suggests that this comet, which was expected to be visible from Earth later next year, may have recently broken into fragments. Given their extremely long orbits, both of these ancient celestial travelers likely originated in the Oort cloud, a large spherical shell of icy debris at the outer reaches of our solar system. C-2023-A3 Tsuchinshan Atlas was discovered in 2023, identified by observers at China's Tsuchinshan or Purple Mountain Observatory and at an asteroid observatory telescope in South Africa. It was officially named in honor of both observatories.
Hi, KORC listeners. This is JC, and I'm sitting here today with Michael Ingram, who is a community artist and author. And he has paintings that are all over the community of Corvallis. And he's honored me with his presence today. Hi, Michael. How are you?
I'm fine. Hi. How are you?
Good, thanks. Yeah. So I was wondering if we could start with your artwork, because I know it's at the library. Mm-hmm. It's at the Old World Deli. Isn't it at the Art Center as well?
Yes, some is there. But where it's really there for permanently is at the Assessor's Building. Which is a new building. Other places that I have them are going to take some in permanently as well.
Tell our listeners a little bit more about your artwork and what inspired you.
Okay, I was a grad student studying literature and philosophy, and I liked art, but I didn't see myself as an artist. And I was at the Guggenheim, and I saw the paintings of a French writer, simplest I think he was, turn of the last century, say, Odilon Redon. And I was stunned. And I said, I've got to do something. So I started exploring different modes, and I came up with a unique style in a brush, which is simply a common painter's corner brush, the cheap one. And I went to town with that.
So, Michael, you use like a spongy kind of brush that you could buy at Bi-Mart.
Exactly, yeah.
And what do you do with that brush? What are the
images? Well, the way I set it up was I had the place where I painted, and then the paint, the acrylics were all over there, and on a whim I'd go, yellow, red, and I just streak it right on the pad and I'd go to work. And I'd have a bunch of papers laid out, thick paper, and I'd paint. And then when I got done, of course, each painting would get a little lower in dimension because of the paint's being spread out. And when I'd get done, I'd have enough left to go back and do background stuff. And that was it. I ended up doing about 500 of those over
time.
So
what subject matter do you choose? Tell our audience, our listening audience, what motivates you to take acrylics using a Bi-Mart corner painter to paint? I mean, what inspires you?
Good question. Dreams. I had sort of kind of quasi-snapping visual images at times that I would paint. I would sometimes wake up at night and, oh, that's it. And I'd had a dream, and I'd rush over to the place where I painted, and I'd paint away. I'd also like to know that all my life I wanted to be a writer. And I had poems and novels just going through my head. But what saved me was I would paint and write. Paint and write. And I did that for years. And finally, I more or less stopped painting around 1995, and I began writing.
You stopped painting in 1995?
Yeah.
Okay. So you haven't painted since 1995, but the work that you've painted is multiple.
Yes.
So it's been reproduced.
The originals are with me. You know, I have those. And there are reproductions. That's true. But the paintings were the key, the catalyst for writing. And that kind of saved me in a way, because I couldn't quite get myself together to do the writing. And the paintings were what got me started. And finally, in about 10 years ago, I said, this is it. And I sat down and I wrote three novels and a book of poetry. And two of those novels, which dealt with the Kent State Massacre, are now in the archives at Kent State University. And one of my paintings is being accepted. There's a place there that commemorates the killing, the massacre there, and it's sort of a semi-art place. And they are going to accept one of my paintings, which is a portrait of an artist after the, excuse me, I get teared up when I think of the Kent State Massacre. So the painting, Portrait of an Artist after the Kent State University Massacre, which happened in May 4th, it was 1970, and it was a catastrophe. The guard walked on the campus and shot a whole bunch of students during a protest against the war in Vietnam. So that was the inspiration for that.
Where's the original painting at?
It's at my place. You know,
Have you done reproductions of the Portrait of an Artist?
Yes, and I show it constantly. The one down at the Old World Deli, I put it there, and then the little thing under it. But yeah, I show it when I think it's appropriate. I make sure that there's not some political angle to it that might upset people, but. It was a catastrophic event for me, and I had trouble after that, and I wrote and traveled and wrote and traveled, and finally I ended up in Los Angeles and underwent a lot of meditation and therapy, and I got my act together. And then that was the kindling part that got me back to writing and painting again. L.A. was special to me, and I still feel that part of me still lives there. And the city was a metaphorical lever, which permitted me my uninhibited desire to discover myself. I could do anything I wanted, walk on her, sit on her benches, look at her lights, ride her buses, etc., etc. So it was like this discovery of myself there when I was in Los Angeles.
Because of the trauma that you felt from Kent State.
Kent State, yes. But also from my days working in a psychiatric hospital. And it was, 5 years I did that. And I had trouble adjusting to that until I finally was able to adjust to it and work there. But it was painful. And I saw shock therapy, and I saw the whole drugs and the whole shot. I was what was called a psychiatric assistant, which I assisted the nurses. And sometimes I had to, wrestle with people and get them in the blue room and make sure they got injections.
So that affected your art? And,
yes.
And so you felt the need to express yourself via visual media.
Well, no, this comes out in the book, my last, the autobiographical novel, Shattered a Light.
So what is that, the most recent book that you've written, Michael?
Shattered a Light is an autobiographical novel that covers a lot of humorous but painful moments in the 1970s during the Vietnam War and all that sort of thing. The massacre at Kent State, my days in Los Angeles. There's some humorous stuff in it as well. So it's a sort of comprehensive portrait of me during those 70s and that. It's a sort of a recovery of myself as an artist and as a poet, again, via Los Angeles, the Los Angeles days.
Is it written in first person, or is it written in terms of from a third eye point of view?
It's a third eye dialogue, but there's also dialogue. And there's internal dialogue where the person is speaking internally, and not in their head, but not verbally. But I might say that the first novel, Busboy, was a shocker. A lot of people have found that really a shock.
Tell us about Busboy.
Yeah, Busboy is it's simply a novel that I developed out of an experience that deals with a young man who in his childhood had a brain injury. And so he grew up, and the only thing he could do is be a busboy. And he inevitably commits the perfect crime, which is a murder. And the humor is the subtlety of the murder scene. And I think that's the shocker. It's not bloody. Believe me, it was a stroke of genius. And even I walk away from it and go, holy criminy, how did I ever come up with this scene where I can have this particular individual with this particular individual where this murder could occur? And he doesn't know he did it. And the humor is the detectives running around trying to figure out who did this ruthless murder when this young man is just this passive little kid working as a busboy.
So where can people pick up some of your books? They sound fascinating.
Amazon mostly.
Okay.
It's on Amazon. And,
do you have any books at the library in Corvallis?
Yes, I do, and I have promised them I would bring the other two. I have two here, but I need to put the other two in.
Okay, so you do have some books here in the library.
Yes.
And people can also access your books on Amazon.
On Amazon, yes.
So you've written Busboy, and then...
another one, Under Appalachian Skies. Beautiful love story. And everybody that's read it goes, you wrote Busboy and you wrote this? Because it's a beautiful love story about two star-crossed lovers. And I grew up in Appalachia, and it's an Appalachian kid who happens to be very brown. He's got a lot of dark secrets, and he's working in a refinery. And under unfortunate circumstances, he runs into or meets this this student, and she's a scholar of literature and philosophy. So the intricate details of how they get together and how they work it out, but she's looking for some kind of sensual, emotional life with somebody, and she doesn't think she'll ever get it. And he's a starving person, even though he dropped out of high school when he was a junior. He's got a genius IQ. He goes to the library and he studies a lot. So they fit together in the sense that he satisfies this sensuality in her, this emotional contact. At the same time, she satisfies his need for knowledge and intellectual discussion. So that there's a lot of interesting discussions about love, sex, philosophical and religious problems of existence of God, problem of evil, et cetera, and you know, it's classic stuff that you would read about in philosophy or religion.
God, that sounds fascinating. You've painted, inspired mm-hmm. by a trauma that occurred, but you've also written. Now, could you tell our listeners if you've done both simultaneously or if you've done them separately, and if you're still currently active in those fields?
Well, as I think I mentioned that the paintings, even though they turned out way better than I expected, they were the catalyst to writing. And I would write, paint, write, and paint, and write, and paint, back and forth for years. And then finally, you know, I ended up with 500 paintings, but at the same time, I ended up writing the three novels and a book of poetry. Yeah, three novels. The third one is the autobiographical one that we just mentioned, Shattered a Light. And then, of course, the poetry it surprised me. I had written this stuff, and it really shocked me at how good it came out. Peter Sears, who was a poet laureate, was inspirational in helping me and inspiring me to write and do the poetry. And I came up with my own rhyming scheme, and to this day, I look at those and I read them, I go, I wrote these? Did I really write these? And my wife has to say, yes, you did.
So, Michael, are you producing anything lately? That set of 500 paintings,
right.
Are you kind of just letting it all to rest now?
You know, I thought I was done, and I thought maybe I would go back to painting. However, I started thinking about Under Appalachian Skies of Star-Crossed Lovers, and I really got into her as a character. I actually fell in love with her as she develops with him.
So, Michael, so you're currently working on editing some short stories that you've written, correct?
Okay. And they're explicit. They're love stories, not romantic. They're love stories of conflict between two people and how they work their and they all learn from this experience. They all learn from this experience, but some of them are true and some of them aren't. The one true one. Let's see if I can do this. This gentleman was given to work with me while I was working in this hardware store, and I got to know him. He was a Vietnam veteran, and he was a gung-ho, I'm going to get the Viet Cong, blah, 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 and he was in a helicopter that was go out and get people that were injured, and he was the gunner. And anyway, he heard this, you know, he was one of these that followed orders, and he heard, jump, jump, and he jumped out of the helicopter, and as he's falling, he sees it blow up. He falls through a set of trees, and the trees saved him. He woke up in Germany 3 months later. And the extraordinary thing is he had to have part of his leg replaced and part of his skull replaced. But the thing that's amazing is everything was intact. His math skills, his reading skills, everything was intact, but his memory was gone. He had no recollection of what happened. Now, he was an all-star football player in the state of California. First-team All-State lineman. And when he went back, he couldn't identify with that. The trophies that were in his room, the people were talking about what a great athlete he was, he couldn't absorb it, and it started to bother him, so he left. And he came to Eugene, And he met, and this is where the love story comes in. He meets this woman, and they become very happy together, despite his handicap and so forth. And they have a couple of children, and they live together. But this is an extraordinary story. I was shocked when he told me that. He had no memory from that moment on.
For the rest of his life?
Yes. He could not get it.
Is he still around?
As far as I know, he's okay. In UG. Yes, as far as I know. It's been a number of years that I have seen him.
So any idea when you might be publishing these short stories?
I am not sure yet. I got to contact my publishers and see if they're still up to doing it. And I want to go through some more revisions. And at the same time, I like to have it professionally edited. I've had all of them professionally edited. By the middle of next year, at least, I might have them published. I'm not sure of the title, but that's something to do with lovers that weren't supposed to be together that come together and as a result grow and learn from the experience.
Michael, I want to thank you for talking with us today, and I want to encourage our listeners to look for Michael Ingram paintings and check out Michael Ingram books at the Corvallis Library. That was an interview with artist and author Michael Ingram, who's a Corvallis community member. Check out his art at the library and at the Old World Deli, and you can also check out his books at the Corvallis Library. You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics.
Күз кез күз, күш кеш күш, кір кер көр, күл кел көл, кілен қысқа сөз кім оқиды тез. Арқада алтар қар бар, қырқада қырғар қар бар, қырғар қарда ағар қар бар, алтар қарда. Көгілдір гүлге қонған аралар гүлдеді, доп деп, дөп деп. Ескекті ескекші еседі, ескекші ескекті еседі, жағажай, жағажайда қамажай. Енелік елеуде еленбейді, итбалық итмұрынды ескемейді, пай, 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 жайылып жүр, тай, ай, 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 шүп етті торғай.